guys. For those of you who are joining us for the first time, welcome. And for those of you who are repeat offenders, welcome back to the Conscious Basket Show. My name is Samantha McCord, and I am the founder and CEO of Conscious Basket. And on the show, we are going to be interviewing extraordinary people just trying to make a difference in this world and giving you tips on how you can too. So as always, if you like what we do, please subscribe, download a couple episodes, and leave a comment below. I will read them all. But for now, let's just dive right in.
Biggest relationship we have with animals is that for most of us, we eat them. And so if you think about that, if you truly want to change how we treat animals, if you want to change and improve our planet, if you want to improve your own health and your own well-being and the well-being of our species as a whole, I would suggest that you really take a hard look at who you eat. And if you're eating animals, to really rethink that. We don't need to eat animals. We're better off not eating animals. As a neurologist and a doctor, I can say you're going to be healthier not eating animals, far healthier. And there is no downside to giving up eating animals, to instead switching. You know, basically you're just switching one plate of food over another. And yet that can have such an immense impact in so many ways. It's just rippling impact.
Today, we welcome Dr. Aisha Akhtar, who is a double board certified neurologist and preventative medicine and public health specialist, whose work points out that there is a mutual benefit to both humans and animals when animals' interests are protected. In this episode, we cover her most recent book, Our Symphony with Animals, Animal Testing and Protecting Human Health by Protecting Animals. Let's dive right in. Hey guys, welcome back to the Conscious Basket Show. My name is Samantha McCord. I am the founder and CEO of Conscious Basket. And today we have the immense pleasure of welcoming Aisha Akhtar. She is a double board certified neurologist. I mean, the list really goes on. I'll explain more about her as we get into the interview. But really the big topic of today is her most recent book, Our Symphony with Animals. And I wanted to get into a little bit about who she is and why she should be someone that you guys follow very closely. So welcome to the show.
Hi, Samantha. Thank you. That was a really sweet introduction.
It's so easy to do. I mean, you really blow me away with all of the different things that you've done throughout your life. I mean, you know, a TED Talk, books, making sure that we have programs for our military for, you know, PTSD and making sure that we're paying attention to, you know, the mental needs of the people in the world. And then also, you also work with making sure that the Center of Disease Control and anti-terrorism, you have like top security clearance. But I know that this is not somewhere that you just poof, this is who you became. So I wanted to talk a little bit about your younger years and how you really got into what you do today.
Sure. So I'll just say, as a kid, for better or for worse, I was always kind of questioning everything when I was a little girl. I mean, there were things when I remember one time, you know, my biology teacher or my teacher, I was in third grade or something like that, in second or third grade in elementary school. And she would hatch these chick eggs, you know, and she would hatch many of them before they're fully, she would break them open so that we could see them in development. So Okay. Basically killing them and things like that. And I just remember, you know, I always had this curiosity. I was curious about, you know, the development of chickens from the embryonic stage forward. So I had that scientific curiosity, but I also felt an unease about what we were doing. And I just remember, you know, I was the only one who, when she said, okay, should we kill this last, you know, chicken that was almost ready to be hatched, should we go ahead and break open the egg? And I was the only one in the class that said no, you know. And so it was always just a part of me. I don't know how or why, but I was fortunate at least to be, I think, fortunate to have that questioning kind of mentality. But I never grew up with animals until I was in 9 years old. And at that time, that's when I became best friends with my grandmother's newly adopted dog, Sylvester. And he's a German Shepherd mix. And I just fell in love with him. He became my best friend, and he was the first animal I really ever came to know. And like so many kids, you know, you bond very strongly with animals. It's just part of our nature to see them. And we see them in a sense almost as equals, you know, in a sense when you're kids, in a way that we don't when we become adults, right? We see them as just another being. They're just different. That's it. They're different in some ways and like us in other ways. So he just was a big part of my journey. He helped me get out of an abusive situation, and that's all relayed in my book. And so I really started after Sylvester, I really started to become much more interested in the world of animals. I would rescue animals, injured animals when I was a kid, bring them home, try to rehabilitate them, or we would rush them to the veterinary hospital or someplace else to help rehabilitate them. So as a kid, I just became more and more aware of animals. I just loved animals so much, and it was just a part of my life. And that had a big role in who I became today.
Yeah. And I think that's something that we talked about even before this. You said, I wasn't riding in cars with boys. I was dreaming of riding in a space station. So since you were a young girl, you've always had that different mentality of, you know, like you said, science, but also compassion. And when we think about who you are today and how Sylvester was a big part, and guys, check out the book. It's really moving the way that we talk about the way that our animals can really directly impact how we heal and how we are able to connect with situations in our life that sometimes aren't easy, as you explain also. But, you know, you as a young woman and grew into, you know, going into school, you always had this focus around animals. And you said it really brought you are who you are today. So tell us a little bit about some of the projects that you're working on right now and really how Sylvester is kind of the common denominator for everything.
Yeah, it's so I'm, as you mentioned, I'm the president CEO, I think you mentioned that, of the Center for Contemporary
Science.
Just
one of the many things, guys. I have to, we'll put it all in the show notes.
we're a new nonprofit organization. We just launched a year ago. I mean, we're only a year old, but our goal is to replace the use of all animals in experimentation within 30 years, at least in the United States, and I would say in some of the European countries in the UK. That's really our goal. And it might seem like a really lofty goal for some people, but I think it's actually an achievable goal. There's a couple of reasons why I think that can really happen. And it's because not only is there an ethical imperative to get animals out of harmful experimentation because they suffer immensely. For anyone who thinks that they're adequately protected, no, they're not. I'll just say no. Mm-mm. Don't delude yourself into thinking these animals are protected. They undergo minimal harm, things like that. Not at all. But there's also an ethical imperative in regards to humans. So more and more the scientific literature is really showing that animal testing, whatever role it may have played in the past, is not really very effective today in really informing human health and informing the types of drugs and vaccines that we need to treat our diseases. So as an organization, we're really working on helping to replace these animals with much more effective, I mean, superior testing methods that are based on human biology, not the biology of a rat or a dog or a cat or monkey, but on human biology. So it's a win-win scenario for humans and animals. So that's the organization I run, but I can talk about many of the other projects I've been involved in.
I think the list goes on, but you know, and something that I just recently wanted to look into, it's just kind of a little tangent, but like plant-based meat versus real meat. And there was a test that was done on mice for the Beyond Meat and Impossible Meat. And I was just thinking to myself, just as you were talking about that, no matter what the information is that you get from this test, it's still done on mice. It's not human biology, like you mentioned. So it's not necessarily giving you the accurate information or keeping you safe or giving you the ability to make decisions for yourself based on your own genetic makeup.
It's exactly right. And that's just, it's just so ludicrous. It's the Food and Drug Administration here in the United States that was requiring that testing. And with rare exception, they require any new drug or vaccine and often food ingredients that they consider novel to be tested on at least two different species. One is usually a mouse or a rat, and then the other could be a dog, a pig, a monkey, or a cat. And they do that despite the fact that we know that about 90 to 95% of drugs and vaccines that pass animal tests, i.e. are found safe and effective in animals, end up failing when tried in humans because most of them end up being unsafe or ineffective in humans. So it's animal testing is so ineffective in predicting what we're going to see. But regulatory agencies throughout the world, not just in the US, but throughout the world, continue to cling to this really old paradigm, this old way of thinking. It's what they're used to, it's habit. You know, there's government inertia. You know how bureaucracy is. It's very slow to change, even though the science is showing there's real urgency to change to protect human health. It's really silly. I mean, it's silly when you think about that we still stick to this way of thinking, even though the science is showing otherwise.
Yeah. And even, you know, we look at the science and it's very clear, but I think that another part that you bring into the conversation is the heart. And I think you do a lot of that with the symphony, Our Symphony with Animals, which you published in 2019. And I wanted to talk a little bit about what gave you the inspiration for this book. We already talked a little bit about Sylvester, but there's so much more that goes into really the circular way that we interact with animals and why that's so important and what it does for our heart and soul.
It's funny because I wrote first a book called Animals in Public Health, which is a little bit more academic oriented, and it really showcases all the different ways how our relationships with animals, how we treat animals, impacts our own health and well-being. And after I wrote that book, I said, I am never going to write another book again. But then a few years later, I started thinking about what else can I do. I'm always thinking about what new approach, what new way can I bring this issue to the public? What new way can I bring it? You know, so I've done a lot of work on highlighting the risks of pandemics from factory farms, from the wildlife trade, exploitation from animals, climate change and factory farming and many things. So a few years ago, I started thinking, all right, what can I do that's different? Again, what else can I do? And so I decided this new book was going to be a slightly different approach. It wasn't going to be just dry facts. It was going to be narrative in nature. So it's what people call narrative nonfiction. It's really stories that drive the overall outline of the book. But within the stories are woven facts, woven scientific information, medical information, things like that. And so I thought that might be a different way to approach the issues. It's a largely emotional approach because no matter what we think we're so logical, we're such logical beings and we make decisions based on logic. We do not. We know that now. We don't make our decisions based on logic. We are emotional beings. And most of our decisions are emotional based. So I thought that if I can, you know, bring in that emotional connection for people with how we relate with animals in the good ways and in the bad ways, you know, how we also exploit animals and kind of bring them into that journey of how that affects our well-being. That was really something that I really wanted to do.
Yeah, and it's done really beautifully. Again, you being so vulnerable in the very beginning of the book, talking about your own story. And I think that the biggest thing that sticks out for me is really how we're all connected and how the connection with animals, women's rights, civil rights, and empathy for animals and empathy for each other is one of, in my opinion, a big theme of the book. And I wanted to hear more about your opinion on that theme so that the listeners can understand what they're getting themselves into when they read this book.
Yeah, so I really tried. I know the beginning starts off kind of dramatically and it tells a little bit about my story.
It's not dramatic though, it's real. My heart goes out to you and also the fact that you were able to be so vulnerable again. And there's so many people out there that resonate with this story. And thank you for doing that.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. The truth was when I was first writing the book, I had no intention of really going into my story. I thought my story is not worth reading about it. So, you know, I really wanted to focus more on other people's stories. But of course, the editors and publishers kept saying I needed to put more of me in the story. So that just kind of forms the background. And you know, you're coming along with me through this journey, basically, as first me as a child and what happened to me as a child and how that led to who I am and to the questions I asked today about how do our relationships with animals impact our well-being. And then you're following me on this current day journey as I travel around the country in the US, meeting different people who've been impacted by animals in different ways. Again, you know, if we're talking about veterans who've, you know, suffered from PTSD and how dogs and other animals have affected them, to the women of domestic violence and how their animals have been so crucial for their survival and their resiliency, to then eventually getting to the point when we start talking about some of the harder issues. You know, when I take people into factory farms with me as I go in there and I start really addressing those issues. And so there's always this balance. So I'm always trying to balance the hard, the sad with the upbeat and the positive. And that was something that I really tried to strike that balance so that it was, you know, the goal was really to appeal to people who don't think about these issues. Mm-hmm. The goal of the book was to reach out to people who love their dogs and cats, who love their pet animals, but don't think about the other animals. So I kind of gently take them into this journey, first with these nice, soft, pushy, feel-good stories, and then into some of the harder-hitting stories, just because I'm hoping that by then, if they followed me on that journey, mm-hmm. they'll be more open to hearing about and reading about some of the harder issues, and maybe they'll be more open to thinking about their role in these areas of how we treat other animals as well.
Yeah, I mean, every human life is impacted by how we treat animals. I mean, whether it's just, you know, the story of the pig during, oh my gosh, Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, or if we're talking mm-hmm. about when we eat too many factory farmed cows and there's antibiotics and things like that, and it overall impacting our health and ultimately getting us all into, let's say, the situation we're in today, because we are so connected. But seeing that we're all so connected, and your experience as, you know, the commander in the US Public Health Service, what would you say is your most frustrating thing that you notice with our relationship to animals and also to the pandemic and what we see today?
Yeah. So I have a TED talk in 2014 in which
super good, guys. She called it out. Move over Bill Gates, because Aisha had it first.
And I was like, Bill Gates, come on. Anyway, but no, I'm joking. Yeah. So I predicted it, but I wasn't the only one by any means. There were other doctors, other scientists are saying, listen, we really need to start focusing on the root causes of our infectious disease rise and on where the next pandemic may stem from. But we've been lone voices, to be honest, in this world. And the, you know, human population doesn't want to hear about it. The media, the mainstream media, certainly have no interest in really highlighting these connections. And our governmental and health agencies have certainly done their best to not really dive deep into these issues. And that was really frustrating for me. That is the most frustrating for me, is that our governmental and health agencies, we knew, my God, we knew the causes, we knew the risks. People have been giving out warning signs about these things, that the wildlife trade and the live markets in China were just the one end result of the larger wildlife trade. But the wildlife trade and then factory farming and how that's stemming new influenza viruses, not the kind of influenza that gives you this little seasonal flu. We're talking about influenza viruses that can cause major, major pandemics, much worse than what we're experiencing today. You know, there's been publications, scientific publications after publications, animal protection organizations have been saying, listen, we need to pay attention to this. But people just stuck their heads in the sand, and our health agencies didn't do their job. We could have predicted this pandemic, but they failed us.
Okay. And you talked, I mean, I actually didn't know about the other, I mean, I knew there was always another strain of the flu, but I always thought it was just kind of like another flu, different flu mm-hmm. shot this year. You just mentioned that there are you know, you talk about the little sister and the big mother in your TED talk. So are these little, not little, but the changes in the influenza virus really what would cause a really terrible pandemic, not this little sister that we've seen now?
Yeah. So, you know, most people, when they think of the flu, they think, oh, I just get the vaccine and, you know, the flu is no big deal. Right. And it's something that only affects the elderly. And even that's very dismissive. I mean, the elderly, we all have elderly, you know, family that we care about. So but what I'm talking about is an influenza A virus that is really dangerous because it can be carried by a variety of different species. So that makes it easy to mutate in many different species. It makes it very easy for the virus to run rampant, and it makes it difficult for us to track and contain that virus. And what we do know is that many different strains of influenza viruses are coming out of factory farms. I'm sure people have heard of bird flus and swine flus and so on. A few decades ago, we had H5N1, which is an avian influenza that came out from China. At least we suspect it came out from China. And that had a death rate of about 60%, meaning 60% of the people who caught that virus died from it. Now, COVID has a death rate between 2 to 3%. So a virus can get far deadlier than what it is now. I mean, so what... Fortunately, that virus wasn't very easy to catch among people. It wasn't one that was easy to spread among people. But that virus is out there. It's still mutating. It's still in factory farms. It's still mutating constantly. It's just a matter of time before one emerges that is much deadlier than what we have today with the COVID virus and can be something that spreads easily among people. So I know influenza is not a scary word for most people, but trust me, it can be among the deadliest of viruses.
Okay. And, you know, like you said, you think of the flu, you don't think really much risk. You think, oh, okay, whatever, I get sick, I only get stronger. But to have a 60% mortality rate is... really, I mean, I haven't ever heard this before, guys. So you're hearing it I'm hearing it first as well. I just feel a little like kind of sad and shocked. And, you know, you think about too, you know, it's directly correlated with factory farming. It's not the only way that a virus can be created. It's not the only way for something to spread. But if everyone is eating animals who are full of so many viruses that they have to take antibiotics to stay alive before you consume them, are you saying that it's just a matter of time before we eat the wrong pork chop and boom, it starts spreading?
So I just want to clarify a few things. So when we're talking about antibiotics, we're talking, these antibiotics are against bacteria.
Okay.
And so not viruses. Vaccines help with viruses, but antibiotics are for bacteria. And so bacteria, we're talking about things like E. coli and Salmonella, which cause a lot of health problems throughout the world. And I don't have the numbers, but high risk of death with some of these infections as well. Those bacteria we can get directly from eating animals and animal products. Okay. We know that multiple studies have been done in which researchers will buy multiple samples of chicken, pork, beef products, eggs, and milk, and so on from grocery stores. They're already packaged, they've already been sanitized in their own way, ready to be used, ready to be eaten. And yet the researchers have found up to 70, 80% of the products contaminated with Salmonella and E. coli and with antibiotic resistant Salmonella and E. coli and so on. So you can catch these diseases very easily from eating these animals and their products. Now for the vaccines, those are for viruses. And, you know, I will say we were very lucky this time. I mean, we had a massive global effort to find vaccines against COVID-19. That normally doesn't happen, as we know, and we're still not over this pandemic by any means. We know that there are still variants out there the virus is out there. It's mutating. Again, it's constantly mutating. So there are variants. We don't yet know how well these vaccines work against these new variants or how well it will work against the next new variant that comes out. And we know that many people throughout the world are not having access to these vaccines, which is also a serious ethical issue in of its own. But my fear is that because there was such a great worldwide effort to find a vaccine, and because there have been some multiple vaccines that came out at a speed that's unprecedented, the fastest vaccine that's ever come out before was 4 years. And it took 4 years for that one. And on average, it takes about 17 years for a new vaccine to develop. So this was unprecedented. And it's great news that we have these vaccines. But my fear is that people are just going to say, oh, these things, pandemics are no big deal. And again, they're going to diminish the importance and think, oh, well, if we have another pandemic, we'll just get new vaccines and not take seriously the root causes of how these pandemics start and how we can prevent them from occurring.
So thank you for clarifying that for me, by the way. I don't know if anybody else out there listening needed that. Let me know if you did. You talk about, you know, I get where completely where you're coming from. You know, it's like, somebody will fix me. Somebody's going to fix it. I can take a pill for that. I can get a shot for that and just fix it. But what would you say the root of the issue would be if we did XYZ for preventative measures? What would you say would be the best thing for us to do?
Well, we do know that 3/4 of new viruses or infectious diseases are coming from other animals. And we do know that it's not the animal's fault either. It's how we treat those animals, it's how we are relating to those animals. So what we do know is that climate change increases our risk for certain types of viruses, especially those that are mosquito-borne, that like the Zika virus, for example. We know that habitat destruction of wild animals brings humans and animals, these wild animals, closer together. And so there are so many viruses that they carry, just naturally carry, that we aren't even aware of yet. But the more we destroy their natural habitats, the more we're bringing humans and animals close together, and the easier it is for new viruses to pass from animals onto humans. We do know that the wildlife trade, we have been capturing animals, breeding them. It's horribly cruel. It's a horribly cruel practice to these animals, and we're shipping them around the globe or killing them on site in these horrible ways, like what's occurring at live markets and other places. As we see that this wildlife trade brings together a lot of very distressed and sick animals, and it makes it easier for them to catch infectious diseases and spread to other animals. And you're bringing together different species. So species which may not normally be in contact with each other. So again, you're introducing new places for a virus to, you know, to jump into, in a sense, right? New species for a virus to jump into, and then it jumps into other animals and then ultimately onto humans. So we know that that's causing a significant rise in infectious diseases. And of course, we know that factory farming is causing a significant rise in infectious diseases. And the main concern, really, when we're talking about viruses and pandemics, is the influenza virus. Now, those are some of the major factors. There are other contributing factors, like human overpopulation. We know that that's a definite contributing factor, and our worldwide travel. We know that's a contributing factor because it makes it very easy for a virus in one part of the globe to travel to another part of the globe. And that's how a pandemic can spread. But as far as the origin of pandemics, as far as the origin of these viruses, most of them are coming from other animals. So that we have to fundamentally look at how we treat other animals.
Yeah, definitely. It just goes back to the same point that you were making in your book, our symphony with animals, the way that we all dance and live together and how we treat each other, not just human to human, but animal to human or human to animal, really. You know, you talked about how the government knew this was coming and we know where it's coming from. Why do you think that we didn't take a closer look?
So let me just say one thing. The government didn't know that this particular virus was coming, but we knew that in general, right? Yeah, we know. I mean, so, you know, I think there's a couple of reasons. One is that it's not an easy issue to deal with because this is global in nature and you need worldwide commitments from many countries, right? You need commitments from China and from other countries, countries which may normally not want to play well with others, right? And so you need that and you need transparency. So it's not, I'm not trying to say that it's an easy issue to tackle. What I am saying is that a significant issue that we must tackle. But I think another reason why our governmental agencies haven't really tackled this is, honestly, most people, they're human beings. They eat animals, for one thing. Most of them are the people who are working in our health agencies, the CDC and other places, they eat animals. So, you know, it's hard for them to take a look at factory farming because that comes back to them, right? Mm-hmm. And the wildlife trade, I don't know why the wildlife trade. I think as far as governmental agencies are concerned, the wildlife trade is big business. So is factory farming. So there's a real economic imperative on the part of governmental agencies to turn their head away from these issues.
Okay. And, you know, I mean, there's so many ways, like you mentioned, for something to spread or, you know, just mentally how we can be around animals and it makes our life better. I mean, there's ways mentally, your physical health. I mean, really everything ties back to everyone being on a higher vibration and better together if we treat animals differently and in a more compassionate way. But if you were to leave the listeners with one thing today, if they only remembered one thing about our conversation, about our direct correlation with animals and what that means for them, what would you want them to know?
I would say that the biggest relationship we have with animals is that for most of us, we eat them. And so if you think about that, if you truly want to change how we treat animals, if you want to change and improve our planet, if you want to improve your own health and your own well-being and the well-being of our species as a whole, I would suggest that you really take a hard look at who you eat. And if you're eating animals, to really rethink that. We don't need to eat animals. We're better off not eating animals. As a neurologist and a doctor, I can say you're going to be healthier not eating animals, far healthier. And there is no downside to giving up eating animals, to instead switching. You know, basically, you're just switching one plate of food over another. And yet that can have such an immense impact in so many ways. It's just rippling impact. And so that if there's one thing you take away from this and one thing that you can do is really changing one plate of food over another.
That's wonderful. I have never heard somebody say it so eloquently, but like, yes, please stop eating animals. It's better for you, the animal, the environment, everyone. So thank you so much for joining us today. We'll be doing part two when we talk about the group that you talked about before in the earlier in the episode. So today was just getting to know you a little bit. So thank you for joining and we'll see you guys next time.
Thanks so much, Samantha.
Bye. Thank you all for joining us on another episode of Conscious Basket. And just a small reminder, Conscious Basket is not just hosting interviews. We are in the process of launching our marketplace, where our goal is to make it super easy for you to make conscious decisions about what you're buying by knowing the origin of the products and services. We're using our technology to highlight a transparent supply chain with our vendors, which means you know what goes into those products and where they came from to make sure those things you buy don't weigh on your conscience. And to ensure this peace of mind, we have developed a score to rank the sustainability of the purchase. For instance, how much water is being used, trees saved, animal lives, human rights, and so on. So, if you're an entrepreneur with a sustainable product and would be interested in being on the platform, please email us at info@consciousbasket.com. Also, if you're an entrepreneur, thought leader, or academic that would like to be a guest on the show, please drop us a line at the same email. And if you're just interested in taking a closer look at us, you can also take a look at our website, which is www.consciousbasket.com. And as always, you can explore the topics we discussed in the show notes and find many more topics on all of our social platforms. So give us a follow on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn @ConsciousBasket. If you like what you're hearing, please subscribe to our show and leave us a comment with any key takeaways. I read them all. Share with your friends, family, post a screenshot on your social about the podcast so that we can extend our reach to help propel our movement forward. Finally, just another small reminder that perfectionism is not the goal here. In my opinion, perfectionism is what gets in the way of all of us collectively picking what I like to call your thing, which is whatever you choose to make a positive impact on this world. Thank you again for joining us.